Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species.
Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk about howler monkeys with Robin Brockett, former director of the Wildlife Care Center in Belize. There are 9 species of howler monkeys, all of which live in the rainforests of Central and South America. They're known for their loud, guttural, barking howls, which can be heard over 3 miles away. Their booming voice gives them the distinction of being the loudest land animal in the world. Howler monkeys are the largest monkeys in Latin America. For instance, the black howler monkey, which is found in Belize, weighs about 15 to 20 pounds and grows to about 2 feet tall, with a prehensile tail that's longer than that, about 30 inches long. In Belize, howler monkeys are referred to as baboons, but they look nothing like the African baboons that we're familiar with. Unlike those old world monkeys, howlers have wide side-opening nostrils and no pads on their rumps. They also are furry and have a long prehensile tail, which they use as an extra arm to grip branches. Howlers are threatened throughout their range by habitat loss, hunting, and the pet trade. Today, I'll talk with Robin Brockett, who spent 16 years in Belize dealing with the fallout from this pet trade. She's researched howler monkeys in the wild and then spearheaded the rehabilitation of confiscated pets back into the wild. Originally, Robin had intended to stay just 1 year as a break from zookeeping. Yet, after she signed on as an assistant field researcher to Dr. Robert Horwich, a noted primatologist and currently director and founder of Community Conservation, Inc. and Howlers Forever, Inc., she stayed on. During her first 3 years, Robin submitted a proposal to the government of Belize's Forest Department and was approved to conduct a feasibility study and project to determine whether confiscated howler monkeys and parrots, which were wild-born and illegally captured for the pet trade, could be rehabilitated to survive in the wild. Her project was initiated in 1998 and, because of its success, led to establishment of the Wildlife Care Center of Belize, which became a nonprofit in 1999. Over the course of the next 10 years, Robin spent hours foraging for the precise species of leaves these vegetarians would eat. As you'll hear, they can be picky eaters, and Robin had to learn what they'd eat and when. Robin has released 31 howler monkeys, and monitoring has shown that the majority of these survived at least 1 year post-release. You can read some of her findings in the almost dozen scientific papers she's already written, and she's hard at work writing up more on her rehabilitation work. Before moving to Belize, Robin Brockett was a primate keeper at Zoo Atlanta for 3 years, where she became involved in behavioral research. Prior to that, Robin spent 3 years at the Bronx Zoo in both the bird and mammal departments, and also time in zookeeper positions at the Franklin Park Children's Zoo and the New England Science Center. She's currently assistant bird curator with the Audubon Zoo in New Orleans. When we spoke, I asked Robin how she first got interested in howler monkeys.
Well, I sort of came upon it by accident. I'd been working in zoos in the States, and I wanted to do some field research, behavioral research. And so I set about writing some letters off to various people. And it took about 3 years before I actually got a position. And what happened was I was working at Zoo Atlanta and one of the vet techs, and I went down to Belize specifically to do some work with the Belize Zoo cross-training. And while we were there, the Wildlife Conservation Society, amongst a couple other groups, were doing the first howler translocation in Belize. And because I had worked at the Bronx Zoo and they were involved, I spoke to them and asked if we could just observe, and ended up actually helping do the triage as they collected monkeys from one area of Belize to release them into another area, which had historically had the monkeys, but no longer had them for various reasons. And so one of the people involved in that was Dr. Rob Horwich, who had been studying monkeys or having people study them for him in Belize at the Community Baboon Sanctuary for several years already, and had set up a community-based conservation program there, which brought tourists to the area and helped protect the howler monkeys. So he agreed to take me on for a year, and I ended up staying with him for 3 years. And in that span of time, I decided not to go back to the zoo right away. And in the first year, I became interested in the pet trade issue in Belize. And specifically howlers, because I had been studying them and learning so much more about them. And I really believe that they had a potential to be rehabilitated and released back into the wild and survive. So I put in my proposal to the Forest Department of Belize, and it was accepted. So that's a long answer to your question.
And so tell me more about the pet trade. Are howlers big in the pet trade in Belize?
Yes. Unfortunately, at the time, it wasn't that big a problem, which also made it seem somewhat of a good time to do a feasibility study of this type. But I had heard and seen howlers as well as spider monkeys in captivity, parrots as well. So my initial proposal was to work with some of the parrot species and the howlers specifically, because that's what I knew the most about. And the Forest Department would confiscate illegally held animals that had been captured from the wild, mostly young animals, and I would go through a series of rehabilitation phases with them, document everything, and then release them into an appropriate habitat and continue the documentation.
Was it usually baby howlers in the pet trade or adults as well?
It was babies at the time. I've seen both recently, but what happens is they generally shot the mothers to capture a baby that was still clinging onto the mother, which means that they were 3 months or younger of age. Sometimes I would get them at 6 or 8 months of age, and they might have been captured recently or they might have been captured younger and held in captivity. Most of the time, the biggest problem was malnutrition with these guys, which is bad, but it's not as bad as some of the other things. You know, I rarely saw anything that had broken limbs, and because they were still young, the malnutrition could be reversed so that they didn't have long-term consequences from that. But the problem is that most people, even living down there, don't understand what their dietary requirements are. So they were giving them rice and beans and totally inappropriate food, keeping them with a tight collar on a leash or in tiny little dirty cages. And it's just, aside from the welfare aspect, it was just, it does take a dent in the population. This type of howler species has very small social family groups. They don't give birth every year, and if they lose an infant like that, it disrupts the entire social system. So there's no good way of collecting an animal for the pet trade that way. I mean, it's just not, it's just heartbreaking all around, really.
What's the attraction? Just having a cool little monkey on your shoulder?
I think that's part of the big issue with the public awareness is until you understand the motives and motivations, you can't really design a public awareness program that's going to reach everybody. And I think there are different motivations. Some people definitely want them as little children, even though they might have their own children. Sometimes it's a substitute. It's just an unusual furry little cute thing that doesn't stay that way necessarily, but they don't understand that. Sometimes it's a status symbol. If it's an illegal animal, the status symbol thing doesn't work that well because they really can't take them out in public and get the accolades that they're imagining they're going to get. But the public awareness is one of the issues down there because we've got a lot of different languages and cultures, and they hadn't done any public awareness as far as the pet trade goes at the time that I started this.
And when was that? That you started?
Pardon me? Oh, that was, I was down there, I started down there in 95, and I actually started the project in 98, but I was doing all the research prior to that and looking for a site to do the project at. Just so you know, the Forest Department has the Wildlife Division under them there, which maybe consisted of 2 or 3 people at the time when I started. Most of the efforts were put into illegal logging and all the other issues that go with managing forests, not just managing wildlife. So they were very short-staffed. They had a very limited budget for doing anything. It's a small country, but it's very difficult to get around. And if they don't even have a vehicle, you know, it's very difficult. So they rely on a lot of outside help for things like the research and for public awareness because they just don't have the resources for it. I shouldn't say they rely on it, but they welcome it.
Is having a howler monkey as a pet illegal or legal?
Yes, it's illegal. It's illegal to capture any species of wildlife for pet purposes. We as a group, the Forest Department, scientists, people in the Lilly Zoo, people who were running rehab projects down there and whatnot, we all got together as a group and rewrote some of the wildlife legislation, and it's still being approved right now. But because it hadn't been written since the 60s probably, and so there was a lot of terminology that just didn't make sense at the time. They were allowing some hunting of some species, and they didn't really know enough about when breeding seasons were, for instance.
Is hunting allowed?
There is some hunting allowed, not of howler monkeys. They're endangered now. They were just upgraded a few years ago to endangered status. There were a lot of species that were not allowed to be hunted at all for any purposes. There are some species that are allowed to be hunted for meat, for instance, some of the deer and the peccary and even the iguanas. I think there are certain seasons that when it's allowed, but none of this was advertised. I mean, basically, if somebody wanted to do the right thing, they had to go in and talk to the Forest Department as well as get their license for their gun, which was a separate issue. But it was also not advertised that it's not legal to keep parrots as pets and whatnot. And it's been such a culturally acceptable thing for so many years that it wasn't, and because of the fact that the Forest Department doesn't have the resources, it was never enforced heavily at all. And it's only been in the last 10 years that they've really been working towards doing that. Of course, that's a double-edged sword, because if you're going to enforce it, what happens to the animals that are going to be confiscated? And that's not why I originally set out with my project, but that's what it became after a while. It's like, okay, well, we know that we have to enforce the laws. We know that there has to be some public awareness, but the end result is that we're going to have a bunch of animals, and what are we going to do with those animals? And nobody's for just euthanizing them. Nobody's for, well, I can't say this. I mean, there were instances where animals were just confiscated and then thrown back out into a jungle somewhere. And all kinds of problems with that. There's no way of knowing if those animals are capable of surviving on their own, if they know how to find food on their own. The disease factor is a huge issue that was not really being addressed properly. Animals in captivity can pick up all kinds of diseases, especially when they're under stress. That might be latent in a population, but until that animal's under stress or they pick up parasites or whatever, and sometimes more serious issues than that, they're endangering the entire wild population if they're thrown back out without any kind of health screening. And then what is the impact on the population, whether it's the same species or different species? There might be a lot of competition going on from that new animal or animals being put into that habitat. So there are a lot of issues that were not being addressed, that there are guidelines out there. IUCN has had guidelines for years about what to do with confiscated live animals. So that was just part of the research that I set about looking into before I started my project, is I want to do this the right way. I want to do it low cost, because a lot of these reintroduction projects might cost millions of dollars, which I don't have, and I don't see. Most people are not happy seeing millions of dollars spent on just a couple of animals being put back into the wild. A lot of the projects are also not done in country, which can also keep the costs low. And is it a species that is really needing to be saved in some way? Even though howlers were not listed as endangered, they were listed as unknown, which means that we had no idea what the population was. We had no idea what the threats were in the long term. They do have a very small geographical range. And again, I was looking at all the factors. The first factor was I knew so much about the species already that I believed behaviorally they could be rehabilitated. And that's what I'm talking about mostly with the rehabilitation, is not a broken limb needing to be fixed. It's the behavioral aspects. Can this animal be trained to identify and find its own food, socialize well with others of its own species, avoid predators, including humans, and know how to be a monkey, even though it's been kept in captivity for however long a period.
Let's talk more about the monkeys themselves and howlers. You had mentioned that they don't give birth every year. How often do they give birth?
Well, the average that we found with this species, you have to remember there are quite a few other, I think there's 9 species off the top of my head I can recall, and they all have very different social systems. But this species, what we were studying, we found about every 15 months they might have another youngster, which is close to a year, but it could be as much as 19, and that's with a normal animal that knows that has had birth. At least one offspring before they're in a regular social grouping. But oftentimes, those social groups were consisting of one male and maybe 2 females, what they saw to begin with. So any offspring is related to the father, which means a female offspring has to, at some point, leave that group and be accepted into another group. And this was all kind of the research that I was watching over 100 monkeys over the period of 3 years within the small area of the community baboon sanctuary in Belize, and doing censuses every single month on about 21 groups, and then concentrating on certain groups that looked like something interesting was happening. Because essentially what Dr. Horwich wanted me to be watching for was changes in groups and troop takeovers. They had seen in their once yearly censuses that they had marked some of the animals. The adults had bands around their legs to identify them. And what they had started seeing in the last few years was a male that had been with one group moved to another group, and sometimes a male was missing. And it was generally the males, but sometimes females. So he really wanted me to document what was going on because they couldn't see it in one census. So I was concentrating on where interesting stuff was happening, where I thought something was going on with the social structure. And within the first month, I documented the first troop takeover, as well as the first time that infanticide had been seen in this species, which was as a result of the troop takeover. So,
and when you say really troop takeover, that's where the male had gone to another group and killed off the other male or drove him away?
Not drove him away is a better way of putting it. I think in some cases, some of the fights that they might have had ended in someone dying, but I only once or twice found bodies, and, you know, unless I saw the entire stage of it, it was a supposition that the animal died from as a result of its injuries. But I did see one male who came in and drove off the resident adult male. There were 3-month-old males with the females in that group. All 3 of those male infants disappeared, and one of them I did see him kill. And that is a strategy that has been documented in other species. Lions are one of the most well-known for it, with a new pride. And the theory goes that the sooner that male can have his genes represented in that group, the better for him, because he might get ousted from the group. So it's a strategy of sorts, even though it's not a, they're probably not aware of the strategy. It's just an urge that they feel somehow. And it's really difficult. I mean, that's when you know you have to do your science, because there's no way of, you know, it's happening up in the trees, for one thing. There's no way of interfering, and there's no way it should be interfered with, because we need to know what these natural behaviors were and are. And all of this information that I was documenting and learning by watching them 12 hours a day sometimes led to what I believe was the success of the project of rehabilitation, because I saw all these things happening and what was normal behavior. This species is very different in a lot of ways. They hold hands.
Really?
Yeah, and they're not all of them hold hands. The ones that hold hands with each other, it's a very, very close bond. And I've seen other things as a result of that. The newborn infants might get passed over or allowed to be passed to even a juvenile in groups that have close bonds, whereas sometimes it's a month old before they'll allow that to happen. The other thing is they hardly groom each other at all, or even self-groom, and yet they're incredibly clean, smelling, looking, feeling animals. Probably it's got to do with their diet. They're mostly leaf eaters. They have a scent to them that's, I love it.
What is the scent?
It smells like steeped black tea. And that's probably because the leaves have the tannins and so does the tea. It's the same scent. And even if it's a windy day and you're near a group of howlers and the wind's blowing your way, sometimes you get a whiff of it. And to me, it's one of the nicest animal smells in the world, and I'm a little bit partial to howlers.
Well, what do they eat? They eat a lot.
Their diet consists of at least 80% leaves. And it's not just any leaf. They have about 75 different species, but compared to how many species of trees there are, that's not really a whole lot in Belize. And they're also very particular about the age of the leaf. There's only a couple of species that they'll eat the leaf all month long or all year long. Other leaves go through different stages. Fig leaves, for instance, and it's a ficus fig, not a Fig Newton fig, but they do have large fruits as well. They have a very high latex content. So at some points, the latex is very high, and it's probably less palatable and less easily digested by the monkeys. So they avoid it at that time. Now, that makes my job as a rehabilitator kind of difficult, because to me, it looks the same all year round. So if they eat 75 different species, I've got to do my darndest to collect as much of that as possible so that I'm giving them the best possible success rate when they go out and find it on their own, and they can identify it, and they're already familiar with the taste and the smell and the look of everything, because they definitely, you know, they look at a plant and then they bring it to them and they smell it and then they start eating it, and sometimes then they'll spit it out. So they sound really picky, and they are. but it's a difficult diet for an animal to have, because they're almost like ruminants. They don't have a four-chambered stomach like a cow, but they have a very long digestive tract because they need to extract a lot of nutrients from a relatively non-nutritious source of food, unless it's fruit. And then fruit they can do a lot better on, but fruit season doesn't happen all year long. It's very sporadic, and it's very weather-dependent. And it's also when a lot of fights might occur, because the monkeys will congregate in a good fruit tree, and it might be right on the border of two territories or two home ranges, and they'll both be vying for the same fruit tree. Which leads me to another interesting...
So is that other 20%...
Howlers is because they have this very large, booming voice, the males in particular, that can be heard for several miles in this species. And the main theory behind why they howl is to identify where they are and to try to avoid any altercations with other groups. And for the most part, it works. And you'll hear in the community baboon sanctuary, you know, I was saying I had 21 groups in a very small area I was following, and you would hear most of those groups go off at a sort of dawn and dusk thing, but actually all throughout the night. Even though they didn't move, they were still, because it was heavily populated, they were constantly letting each other know where they are.
So it's less aggressive reasons for booming voice and more just, I'm here, don't come here.
Exactly. That's what I believe and what most other people believe. There are different vocalizations as well, and if they do have an altercation, generally those announcements of I'm here will last about 10 minutes, almost exactly to the minute.
Really?
So when I would be woken up at 1 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning, I would just finally realize, okay, well, I just have to make it through 9 more minutes and then I can go back to sleep. But if they're very close to another group and they're being territorial and there might be an altercation, that howl could go on an hour. And it's very exhausting to the monkeys, too. You'll see that the males just they can't do anything but just rest afterwards. So it takes a lot out of them.
And is it both the males and females who do that howling vocalization?
Well, the females sound like creaking doors. They sound like they need a little bit of WD-40. But they do join in, especially, they might not do it in the announcement howl, but they will join in with the other ones. And if there are going to be combative fights, it's generally the males will fight the males and the females will fight the females. And the females are every bit as tough and sometimes violent as the males. I've seen some serious injuries from them. They don't do it very often, but when if they actually get another monkey in hand, there are some deep gashes from their canine teeth, which is another reason that they don't make good pets, because it might not happen just any time, but they have the potential to really do some injuries.
And how big do they get?
Well, this species is pretty large. It's larger than the one that's found in Costa Rica, and there's quite a size difference between the males and females as well. They can get about, what is it, I'm trying to think, 13 kilograms, I think, was our heaviest one that we got. So 15 to 20 pounds is not unusual for a male, even a little heavier than that. Yeah, I'd say 15 pounds is more like a female, and 20 to 23 pounds of male.
You had mentioned that 80% of the diet was leaves. Is the other 20% fruits?
Fruits, flowers, stems. That, you know, when they're, we had some PhDs at the same time I was down there. That actually, prior to that, before they did the translocation, they had two scientists down there studying specifically what the animals ate, and then going to the release site and making sure that a good percentage of the same species was there, as well as what time of the year they flowered and fruited, so that they chose the optimum time to release them, that they wouldn't have to really search hard. It would be the fruiting season, and not the, and which is kind of the end of the dry season as well. I took a lot of the information that they found, not just the species of plants that they were eating, but how they did their actual releases, and used that for my project as well. So it wasn't just going blindly. I was following established guidelines and recent research and getting a lot of feedback from people who were involved in that, as well as other projects that might not have been successful, and trying to figure out, well, how could we tweak this a little bit to make it successful and to give these animals the best chance possible.
It just sounds so complex, because just to feed animals in your care, you actually have to be a botanist. Even if the 75 is a small proportion of the species available, that's a lot to know a lot about each one.
It is. Well, you know, I still don't know the Latin names of them. I made up my own names, partly just for my ease, but also when I started having volunteers, there was no way I was going to expect them to learn these plants, and I usually had to flag plants for them, and it would take them 3 to 4 hours to collect just one day's worth for four monkeys sometimes. And sometimes these volunteers were only there for 2 weeks, so it would take a whole week and a half until they got that down. And for me, it was a constant learning process. If an animal was doing well and not a very young animal, I would sometimes try stuff that I wasn't so sure about, and because I certainly didn't want to give them something that was toxic. But at that point, when I was experimenting and giving them something additional, it was something that I knew wasn't toxic in general, at least as far as I understood it for humans, because a lot of the care is based on human pediatrician, health-wise, veterinary-wise. You can't follow anything but human medicine for these guys, even though there's a lot of differences. But the plants, if an animal is already showing some, as I said with the figs, they're not always palatable to them. So if they've already demonstrated that they're leaving it at some points, then I can bring in another plant, and they might take a bite and it's not going to hurt them. And if they love it and I don't see any adverse effects in a couple of days, then I add that to the plant list. And sooner or later, I might find a researcher who said, oh, yes, I have seen them eat that plant. You know, I might have to send a photo off to them and describe it and all that. But, you know, and that's part of it's constant learning process. Even after 16 years there, I was still learning stuff about howlers, their diet and otherwise. And no two animals are alike either. They definitely have different personalities, and some need to be treated differently. Even if I got two in that were 4 months old, and you know, one might need to have a lot of extra care, and one just wants to be left alone and knows when the food's coming in there, and then I'm going to just put it in there and leave them to eat alone. And so it was a constant learning process with them.
Tell me about a typical day. Who brought you a howler monkey, or did you go on the on the operations to actually confiscate the monkeys, or what happened? How did the whole
I rarely did that, although in the last few years I did do that, partly because we didn't have enough staff in the forest department to be trained on how to handle an adult, for instance, or there were different issues. But for the most part, I didn't go on the confiscations. They would say, listen, we're going to get to confiscate this monkey. Can you take it? And I would always say yes to howlers. I would say no to a few things. But howlers, I could always accommodate them because they were so susceptible to stress and everything else. I hated to leave them anywhere when I knew I could do something with them. Sometimes somebody would hear about me and they didn't want to deal with the forest department, even though they weren't doing any kind of they weren't finding people at the time, and still they didn't want to deal with that. So they'd hear about me through the grapevine, and they would call me up or just come by and have an animal. And sometimes I had to be talked into giving them up. There were a couple of people that I think I spent weeks, even months, talking to them, and in the meantime trying to give them some information about how to keep this animal alive and healthy, but also trying to let them get to know me a little bit and what my motivations were and how I was going to deal with these animals and allow them to have some follow-up with the animals. It was not my favorite thing to do. I just wanted to get the animals and get them in a different situation. But typical day probably began at 5:30. It depends if I had any birds. I had some arasaris, which are a small toucan, that woke up at 4:30 every morning and had to be fed about every 20 minutes all throughout the day until about 6 p.m. And then, so sometime I had to stuff as much as I could in and run down to the river and collect the browse for the monkeys. And at that point, I was doing it two or three times a day, but I later got my methods down so that I could collect once every 2 days and keep it fresh in a plastic bag and have it wet and in the shade. Not ideal, but certainly a time saver. I was also still completing my outhouse and the stairs to get into my cabin and all kinds of various things when I first started. So I pretty much didn't sit down or stop moving between 4:30 and 6:30, and then I kind of collapsed. Unfortunately, I didn't have any animals that had to be fed overnight. So, but typically when I got into the routine of it, the first monkey feeding should be about dawn or a little after dawn, 6 to 7. 7 is about the latest. If they're really young, they have to have formula as well as the leaves. And when they're on the formula and they're not eating it, you have to act like the mother and act like you're eating the leaf so that they want to take it from you. It's a psychological thing.
I was just about to ask how you get them, teach them to eat leaves.
There are very few of them that'll just pick up a leaf and know what to do with it. And again, they don't know the correct leaves, so I have to bring them the right leaves that I know are safe, and I have to act like mom, and I have to do the vocalizations like mom would do so that they grow up to be social beings of the right species. And I was very, very strict at the beginning, and mostly with the parrots because they are such good imitators. They'll pick up anything, and if they think it amuses somebody around them, they'll do it even more so. So I didn't speak my own language around them anywhere in hearing distance, and they still managed to pick up stuff, because it's just impossible. The howlers, I would do the correct vocalizations. When I got one, the first time I'd get one in, I had to give a vocalization that basically said, it's okay, I mean you no harm. Somebody who doesn't know any better might start howling, and that would be about the worst thing you could possibly do for a young howler that's stressed and in a strange situation.
Can you do the vocalization that says, I mean you no harm?
Yeah, it's kind of like a I don't know if that's coming across the line very well, but it's something that I hear infants do, mothers do to infants, two juveniles playing together for the first time, or, it's always a positive thing, and it's not necessarily the vocalization and I'm going to jump on you and bite you sort of thing. It's never that way. It's always kind of feeling each other out. And they purr when they're sleeping, the babies especially. Some of the adults do, but it's generally just an infant thing to do. And if they're stressed in any way, even when they're exhausted and they're sleeping, they don't purr unless they're content. And they feel they're warm, they're fed, they're clean, they're in the right temperature, everything. And so when I'd hear that purring for the first time, I'd breathe a sigh of relief myself because I knew that, you know, we've passed that stressful part already. And it's a very fine line because they do need socialization, they do need comfort and care, and yet if you overdo it, they're never going to be monkeys. So a lot of it looks like, what do they call it, tough love to the uninitiated. I don't carry them around with me all day. I can't do that for all kinds of reasons. Impracticality, dangerous to them, too warm. They have to be in the right temperature all the time. The disease factor, every animal that came in has to go through quarantine because an illness doesn't necessarily show up right away. It might be a week or two later that the stress from the capture shows up and all of a sudden they get a runny nose or something. And if they're all being kept together, everybody's going to get sick, and you might lose all of them. I fortunately didn't have too high mortality, but the really young ones, it's hard to get them through anything. So it's a fine line. When they would get the comfort and care, I'd take them out, and I'd, for lack of a better word, cuddling them, vocalizing with them while they got their formula. I might keep them out for a while, try to get them to eat some of the other stuff, a little bit of play. But basically, it's about half an hour at the most, and then they go back in, and as an infant generally is sleeping most of the time anyway. So it's a good time to get them used to going back into a kennel. It's a safe spot. They have their little hot water bottle and their hammock and whatever else they need. And it's a quiet time. And the sooner they get into a good routine like that, the less stress they're going to feel. When they start becoming more active, they're already used to being put back into the kennel, and it's their alone time, but they have limbs then and vines maybe to swing on, and they go into gradually larger enclosures. There's a heavy tendency for most rehabilitators, partly because I think they haven't watched what is natural behavior with a wild species, whether it's a rabbit or a squirrel or whatever. They want to do what they think that animal needs because they're anthropomorphizing. And granted, a howler monkey stays on its mom all the time, but that mom doesn't have to go and take care of 20 other different species and everything else. And howlers also are independent at a very young age compared with most other primates, which is another reason I thought that I could be successful with these guys. At 3 months of age, they're clumsy, but they're already going off mom and exploring around a little bit. They'll still travel with her, but they're not on her all the time. So that's pretty young for any primate species. At 8 months of age, they might be fully weaned. She might be pregnant. She's definitely pushing them away. They don't get up until that point. They're being weaned pretty drastically after about 4 or 5 months compared with how often they're allowed to nurse before that. 8 months, they might still sleep with mom, and then they'll get an opportunistic suckle in, but they're not really allowed to during the day, and they're expected to travel on their own, and they're playing with other group members at that point. So it's very early. So putting them in a kennel by themselves, and they're fed, they're warm, they're just going to go to sleep for the most part, is the best thing to do for them.
Do they get to be with other howlers?
That's the ideal point. Generally, they did know of quite a few. Sometimes I got two in at a time. And as soon as they get through that initial 30-day quarantine where I know that they probably aren't going to be sick and they're not going to pass anything on to somebody else, then I could start an introduction process. With really young ones, it could go very quickly, a day or two, at 4 months, 5 months of age. Can't really do it before that because they're still clinging, and they tend to cling on to one clings onto the other, and that's very unnatural, and it's distressing to the one that's being clung onto because it might be the same size or even smaller. The males tend to do it more than the females, too, strangely enough. I think we might find that in some other primate species. Yeah, the introduction process is one of the most critical. And so young animals, sexually immature and generally under 1 year of age, were always easier to introduce and become a cohesive social group than the older ones, where they are starting to feel more territorial and the play might be more aggressive. And when they become sexually mature, they're not interested in playing so much as finding a mate. There were times when I had only a solitary animal, and rather than hold that animal over again, and generally they were already kind of older as well, they might be 2 years or more in age, I would do a release more quickly with them and release them as solitaries, which wasn't ideal, but it was kind of normal for the species, because what I saw was that, as I was mentioning before, they have small family groups, and generally if there is one male and one adult male and two adult females, and you have another a female born, she's not going to breed with the male. It's incestuous if she does, and somehow they've got this mechanism inside that gets them to move out of the group, whether it's they're chased out or they leave on their own. And most of the time I saw them just leave on their own. And then they go around, and sometimes it could be a year before they are able to join another group. And they're right on the boundaries of their home range, their natal group home range. So they're familiar, and they know where their feed trees are, but they're not really tolerated too well once they start leaving the group. It's not a full-on chase, but they're not made to be welcome anymore. They need to go out, and eventually they'll join their own group, or I've seen solitaries hook up with each other as well. So that happens about 2 years of age, which was the age when I started releasing animals. I realized within the first couple of years that I could release them even younger than that, and they would do fine as long as they were in a social group.
So typically you waited until they were 2 years of old, 2 years of age, or you'd start forming groups and release groups?
I would start forming groups as soon as possible, not 2 years of age. That's too old, actually, because they're feeling more territorial at that point. The original plan was I won't release them before they're 2 years of age. But I started changing that because they were doing so well, the younger ones in the group. I mean, there's only one good release time during the year. I did do some releases other times, but I was following what worked for the translocation, which is the highest fruiting season. It's dry season so that I can follow them and monitor them, and yet it's almost rainy season so that by the time I'm not offering them extra food and water, it's rainy season and they can find their own water, and they're already eating the fruit and the leaves on their own. The social bonding actually became one of the most important factors. So age wasn't so important. As long as they were about 8 months or older, the youngest in the group could be no younger than 8 months old, because they're just too small. And some predators, some of the birds of prey actually will, even vultures I've seen go after a 6 to 8 month old juvenile if they're off on their own, just the size wise alone. So if they're closely bonded, they're all looking out for predators. They're very synchronous in their activities. If one eats, the other ones eat, which was another good thing about getting them into groups as soon as possible. Sometimes there are finicky eaters. As soon as they get into a group that's got a good eater, you'll see everybody just blossoming and becoming a great eater.
And peer pressure.
Well, it's not. They're just so synchronous. If they sleep, they all sleep together, except the adults sleep and the juveniles are playing. But for the most part, the eating definitely is synchronous, and traveling is synchronous. Once there's usually one or two in a group that decide when it's time to move off to another feed tree or to a sleep tree, and the other ones will stop what they're doing and follow them, if they're paying attention.
<they're not. laughs> And how big are the groups that you'd put together?
The largest I had was five, but sometimes it was the first two I released was just two because that's all I had. And then I skipped 1 year, but every year after that, from 99 to 2010, I was releasing groups and or solitaries. And the solitaries are also much more difficult to follow, especially if I got them in older. They just keep moving away. And the thing about observing them and really finding out what's going on is to be as invisible as possible, which is difficult because they look at me as their caregiver, but all the phases that they go through up until release are getting them further and further away from needing me. The first phase, essentially, they might be infants, and so there's a lot of hands-on and caregiving throughout the day, but they don't sleep with me. They sleep in their hot water bottle, and they're wrapped up in fleece if need be, and then they go into the outside areas, and then they're with groups, and that, as soon as they go in the social groups, they realize how much more fun another monkey is than me. I mean, I can't swing by my tail and jump around and bite them like somebody else can. And then they go into a pre-release enclosure, which is also a really critical phase of the rehabilitation, because as big as I can make a cage, I can't put the kind of limbs in the cage that they need to learn how to move on. Some of the palm fronds, for instance, are the big deciding factor when they go into the pre-release. The heavier animals will go right down to the ground if they jump on a palm frond. They have to learn to judge a branch and whether it's going to hold them or not before they just walk on it and maybe drop to the ground. So the pre-release is actually a natural habitat with an electrified fence around it, and it could be about 3 acres in size, with a cage inside. So the cage is exactly the same sort of cage that they've been in up until that phase. They're held in the cage. It's actually designed almost exactly like the release when it happens as well, because it's what we call a soft release rather than just releasing them out of the cage. They are held in the cage, and they acclimate to the area before they're released. And then it's kind of a slow, soft release with these guys. They're used to coming back into the cage to get their food and their water, and I'll lock them in for the first few nights, and then I'll have the open access to the cage. But they're always fed in the cage so that I have some control if something goes wrong, whether it's in the pre-release, and actually I need to have more control in the pre-release so I can catch them and put them in their kennels and move them to the release site. In the release site, the cage serves the same sort of factor, but hopefully I won't need to catch them up. But I have had to do that with one release that I did where an animal became injured, and if I hadn't had that control, that animal would have died a slow death from infection. And in this instance, I was able to get him back into the kennel, start him on back into the cage, start him on antibiotics right away, and he survived. So.
And then did you release him later again?
Well, unfortunately, he had to be euthanized later, but it was much later. He had other health problems at that point, but it wasn't related to this issue. I have had to recapture a couple of howlers that didn't do well during the release. And this was another thing about the socializing. They were both young howlers released with one sexually mature adult, and they did not have time in the pre-release because I knew that I wasn't going to have that control with the adults because they had come in as adults, and they wouldn't have come back into the cage. I wouldn't have had any control over them. They probably would have gone right over the electric fence even though they'd get shocked. This is another reason that younger animals, it works better. They have, you know, more plastic minds and behaviors. So these two howlers, it was separate instances, but I had to recapture them and release them at a later date. They were both released at later dates. They both did fine. But they probably would not have survived if I had just not been able to catch them and redo the rehabilitation without having this control, having that cage. And it really is only necessary for a week or two. I've found that I keep offering, I even offer browse in case they don't find enough on their own. But, you know, I've done the research. I've done the botanical surveys in the release site, so I know that there's enough food for them. But sometimes it just helps. For me, I need to know for sure. So they get browse, food, and water. They never take the browse after they're out of the cage. They have always found enough browse on their own. Sometimes they'll come down for the fruit, but generally by the end of the second week, they don't take the food anymore. So it's actually very quick. It's quicker than I usually thought it would be. And it's all, as I said, every phase is designed so that they are less and less dependent on me for their survival in whatever way. And that's part of the thing that a lot of rehabilitators I've seen, they don't want to give up that that bond and that closeness, and it's so essential. If you're going to do a release, you've got to prepare these guys, and it means, you know, I don't have children, but I can imagine when your child goes off to college, it's the same sort of feeling. You want to let them go, you want them to do their best, and yet you're going to miss them. There's going to be a void in your life, but what is best for that child or that monkey? You've got to keep that in mind all the time.
After they do this pre-release area, you move them to an area that you've already scoped out that you know is appropriate and can handle additional howlers?
Yes. Well, it's not additional, actually. IUCN guidelines for this type of program recommend that it's a low to non-existent population of the species in that release site. So I was going for a non-existent. And when I did the pre-release surveys, we found absolutely no evidence of howlers. And yet, it is supposed to be a habitat that at least historically had that species in it. Otherwise, there's probably a reason why they don't exist there. You can do botanical surveys, wildlife surveys, and whatnot, and there are some areas that just have never had howlers to our knowledge. But for the most part, most of Belize in suitable habitat did have howlers at some point.
Robin, what were some of the successes of your releases? You said you monitor them afterwards. Do you do a census of release areas later on?
Yes, I do. It's actually 3 straight weeks of monitoring them, sleeping in the jungle right near where they've been released and following them 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. and collecting data constantly. And then after the 3 weeks, they're weaned off of anything they need to have water-wise and food-wise. They've also, within that 3 weeks, established part of their home range. And I've found that over and over again. 16 animals have been released at the first site, 9 at the second site, and a few more in different areas. But I always go in, I keep going in as often as I can after that first 3 weeks. It might be every other day, it might be once or twice a week, and I keep monitoring them, and that's how I know they're still using the same areas, and I can find them because they have established that home range, at least in part. I always do a 1-year post-release census of those animals as well, because that's kind of the determining factor. Well, how well have they survived? And in every instance, the groups that I've released have remained together and are surviving and are still within that core home range release area, except for one instance. They've all survived and stayed together at least 1 year post-release. There is some movement after that time, and generally I'm doing another release the next year, so during that release, I'll have time when they're still being held in the release cage to go around and census the other areas. I know that I've had at least one released animal. She was rescued when she was 6 months old. She has reproduced and raised her own offspring. So socially, she knew what to do. And I certainly didn't teach her how to be a mother that way. And she probably bred with a wild male. This is the other interesting thing. Even though the area had not had any wild howlers probably since the mid-1980s, and we think people in Belize believe that it was hurricane damage, and it was not so much damage to the forest, but the fruiting cycle was damaged, so that the animals probably moved out of the area. Every group that has been released has been joined by at least one wild adult animal, and in some cases, a couple more than just one. And they have all been joined without any overt aggression being observed. So that's, again, a good indicator of the socialization has been just right, because otherwise they wouldn't know what to do with this stranger and they wouldn't be acting the right way. They're reproducing with them, and the wild population is slowly moving back in. And the hopes now is that I can get in next year to this original release area and find out what the numbers are, because they were already increasing from 0 to 16 that I released to probably another quarter of that, 4 or so additional animals at the last census. The second area where I released 9, it's now up to 14, and I was able to census that area last year before I left. So that's the really important thing now, is even though I might not be able to identify individuals that I released because they were not permanently marked, just the numbers alone, and especially if they have offspring, will be a huge indicator of success of the project. And can that forest support any more as well? But now we're running out of areas where
I was about to ask, you know, is there enough space to release howlers?
Well, no, there isn't. And, you know, this was never intended to be a long-term project. This was a feasibility study. This was not a solution to the pet trade. And it is not a solution to the pet trade. The pet trade needs to be addressed through public awareness and enforcement. And the forest department down there is enforcing, but the public awareness is still not happening in the scope that it needs to. I did a couple of posters while I was there, and I'm still working on some aspects now, actually targeting the expat community and the tourists, because they're actually perpetuating the pet trade unknowingly. And so they, more than the local population, need to be educated, because the local populations that are trying to sell these animals often will approach expats or tourists, knowing that they know no better and that they have the money. And they're rescuing, and I say that in quotation marks, this animal that they don't know anything about, and they don't know what's going to happen to it. The zoo can't take any more howlers. As I said, they've got small social groups, and they don't just take on another animal. There are very few facilities in Belize and elsewhere that are qualified to accept these animals. So having the facilities and having the release projects is not the answer. That was, as I said, I went about that to see if it could be done. I learned a lot about the captive requirements and what could be done. And I also, in the meantime, talked to so many people in country, the expats, the locals, the tourists, trying to get into the mindset of what makes these people want to have these pets, what could possibly deter them from doing that. And that's really what we have to do now. And the tourism is such a huge business down there that if it's approached the right way, and if we can get even a small percentage of those tourists to comply or to take on this responsibility of diplomatically letting these local people who are trying to sell them the animals in whatever way. It's not as overt as that a lot of times. That, I truly believe, that will cut down so much of the pet trade if the market is taken away. That's what happens. There's still going to be a small local percentage of people who want those pets, but that's not the big pet trade problem right now. It's the tourist business, and there's all kinds of little illegal roadside zoo type things that have a lot of different species of wildlife, and the tourists will just flock to those places because they want to see the wildlife, even though we've got a great zoo there, and they can go out into jungles if they go on the right trips and see these animals. It's the fast tourist traffic, like the cruise ships that come in for a day or two, and they just go out in these huge numbers. It probably only take a small percentage of these people who are aware that it's illegal to have these animals, that we are doing something to stop it, and that they have the possibility, even if they're there for half a day, of influencing positively the end of a pet trade. And I think giving them the right tools is a big part of it. Well, they actually had a lot of power still. They write to the right people, and I guarantee you something's going to happen. It has to go to the tourist board. It has to get out in the press, because that's where the pressure is going to come from. Well, rather than say we can't do anything, you put the pressure on certain areas, and they keep having that pressure, and it keeps getting out in the press. That looks bad for tourism. Something happens. Because I still feel a responsibility. This is my big passion, is not just for Belize, but for everywhere, to try to control this pet trade issue. It's gotten out of control. Even if it's not hurting the populations in their countries, it's just not right.
And so there's really a lot that almost anyone can do in terms of sharing information, getting the word out that this even exists.
I do think so, yes.
And avoiding those kind of roadside zoos and avoiding being a market.
Right.
For
and it's
them.
Just, you know, sometimes it's just one little comment to somebody. Just, I really don't like seeing this. And you know what? If I had known about this, I wouldn't come here, and I'm going to spread the word. And that's not great, but, you know, that kind of thing, if it's a tourist business, you know, that's when it's going to work. Unfortunately, we do have to sacrifice some animals along the way. Nobody wants to hear this, but the more somebody pays $25, $50, whatever it is, to rescue that animal and take it somewhere, every time somebody pays to save that one animal, which actually might in the end not be saved at all, another one is coming out of the wild because that market is being perpetuated. That's the first and foremost thing that most people need to understand.
Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today.
You're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about howler monkeys with Robin Brockett, zookeeper and wildlife rehabilitator. Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelneamy.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelneamy.com, and at laurelneamy.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the AnimalWise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelneamy.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Neamy, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.